I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of the sport of bodybuilding, as well as about the history of bodybuilding. And on today's show, we are going to have part two of our interview with Jerry Branum, where we are going to talk about the year 1978. Right when we started the new year, we were doing reviews of shows from 50, 40, and 30 years ago. So 2 weeks ago, we had part one of our interview with Jerry, where we talked about the year 1968, and today we are going to talk about the year 1978, and this is in commemoration of the new year, because we're not going to talk about 2018, because we are, of course, the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk about the old days of bodybuilding. So last time we talked to Jerry about 1968, and we had some great stories about Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sergio Oliva. And this week we are going to talk, as I said, about 1978. So we're going to talk about the 1978 Mr. Olympia, which was Frank Zane's second Mr. Olympia win. And we're going to also talk about what made Frank Zane such a great champion. And then we're also going to talk about the 1978 Mr. America contest that Tony Pearson won over Ron Tuffel, and that was kind of a controversial contest. So we're going to get Jerry's views on that. And then we're going to finally talk about Mike Mentzer winning the 1978 Mr. Universe contest, where he won with a perfect score. So that we're going to have a really good interview with Jerry Branum. And right off the bat, I do want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning Fat Burner Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe contest in 2012 in the Masters division. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion, and Breon was also the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banut and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 when you go to oldschoollabs.com and you will get 12% off your order. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. And Old School Labs has come out with a lot of new supplements, so be sure to check out their website and check out all the different supplements they have. They're really expanding their line. All right, so how's everybody doing out there? Hope everybody's training is going good. I hope everybody enjoyed our tribute show last week to Ed Corney. I really was happy with the way that show turned out. We sort of put it together at the last minute because Ed passed away on January 1st. Last week, I also heard about another death in the bodybuilding world. Daryl Stafford, who was a top NPC national champion. He competed against Sean Ray in the 1987 NPC Nationals and took second. And he also won the light heavyweight class against Mike Quinn in the 1987 NPC USA. And I believe Daryl eventually got his pro card. But he died last week at only the age of 58. And I believe it was a heart attack, according to Lonnie Tepper's post on Facebook. And I guess Daryl was also suffering from diabetes, so my condolences to his family and friends. That's a very young age to go, only 58. And Daryl was a great national, like I said, he was a great bodybuilding champion during his time in the 1980s. I want to give a shout out to Ty Clifton from Bombers Gym in Oklahoma. Ty emailed me a while back and he said he was going to send me out a t-shirt, and he did. So I got that in the mail this week. So thank you, Ty. I'll be wearing that to my to the gym for my workouts. Looks like I'm going to be going out to California again next month. Old School Labs contacted me, and they want to do a series of interviews with the great Tom Platz. So they want to do it out in California. So I might be heading out there around February 11th, the week of February 11th. So I'll keep you guys posted on that. That should be exciting. Always love going out to California. Hopefully I'll get to go to Gold's Gym and get a few workouts in, maybe hook up with Phil Williams again for some more workouts. So I hope everybody enjoyed, as I said, our tribute show last week to Ed Corney. I thought it really went well. And one part of the show I really liked, in addition to my interviews with Mike Katz and Roger Schwab, was I read that article at the end of the podcast, and it was from the December 1976 issue of Muscle Builder magazine, and it was actually written by Ed, and I thought it really gave us some great insight into Ed's motivation for the sport and what he thought about bodybuilding. And I thought there were some great stories in there about training with Arnold for the 1975 Mr. Olympia. So I asked a few people who I knew who listened to the podcast what they thought of that, because I really was happy with the way it turned out. I did hear from Scott Barron, who is a big listener to the show. Scott always sends me emails to let me know what he thinks of the different episodes. And Scott said, "I thought the Ed Corney tribute podcast was very well done. Also, the article read aloud at the end was excellent. In fact, I recommend that you incorporate doing this on a semi-regular basis, perhaps every other podcast, which adds depth and continued format variety. It's also great to see that Big Mike and Roger Schwab continue to be such loyal guests on the show. Keep up the good work." I also heard from Scott McNally from Bodybuilding Nerds Radio. And as you know, Scott and VJ Puri, every week on the show, they review podcasts from shows about bodybuilding. So I asked Scott what he thought of it. And he said, "John, I thought about it. For me personally, that was the single best thing you've put on your show. I went back to pick out a 1 minute clip for Bodybuilding Nerds Radio, and I listened to it again today. When I think of Ed, I think of that famous squat scene in Pumping Iron, and this article embodies everything I get from that scene and vice versa." So that was really nice to hear. I got another email from Scott Bivens, and Scott said, "I'm really glad I found your podcast channel. It's very rare interview content. Man, this is super exciting to hear you, a legend, also interact with other legends. Mike Katz does like to hear himself talk, huh? You did well to bring him back to the topic, John. He's not an easy one to keep on point. But I never knew Ed was so well respected until this interview. Thank you." I also got a message from Mike Liptrot, and Mike says, "Hi, John, I hope you're well. I just wanted to say how much I enjoy your Bodybuilding Legend show. That was a really nice tribute to Ed Corney. I particularly enjoyed the article you read from the end of the show, a real insight into the man and the legend. By the way, I really enjoy your updates about your training and what you've been up to. I often fast forward other podcasts to get to the meat, but yours is one I listen to from beginning to end." All right. Thank you, Mike. And I put the Jerry Branum interview part one, I put that up on YouTube, and I did get quite a few comments on YouTube about that podcast. Steven Serial said, "Very entertaining interview. Jerry is a great guy." Scott Barron also made a comment on YouTube. He said, "John, good job with the video clips of Vince Gironda and Sergio Oliva. Also, I thoroughly enjoyed the Phil Williams and Jerry Branum podcast interviews. Happy New Year." Joey McFadden said, "I wish I was training with those guys back then, being at Vince's gym and the original Gold's Gym. It had to be a fun time." Luis Gomez says, "John Hansen, thank you for getting back to me. I'm a really big fan of your YouTube channel. Wow, I could just imagine how Sergio must have felt. I would like to know more about Sergio Oliva in one of your future YouTube videos. Happy New Year, John." Creative Media said, "These videos with Jerry Branum are pure gold. Thank you so much." Joey McFadden also made a comment about Mike Katz. He said, "When you look at the front double bicep shot of Sergio, it looks like the great, late great Mike Matarazzo. Big Mike's arms were well past 22, and his forearms were out of this world, and Sergio's arms and forearms looked just like that. And keep in mind that those pics were at least 30 years apart, and Sergio didn't have access to the gear they had in the 90s, back when Sergio took those pics. That's why I believe Sergio had the best genetics of all time." Pat Comer said, "Ed Corney show was great. Can you imagine Big Mike Katz being fresh from being a guard for quarterback Joe Namath, heading to the Middle East 2 months after the massacre at the 72 Olympics, where the Israeli strength athletes were killed, another international athletic event involving weightlifters. It's no wonder they held his passport. Thanks again for all your work in bringing us these stories." Iron Warrior made a comment on YouTube. He said, "John Hansen, I believe Sergio was banned from competing after 72 by Joe Weider as punishment for having competed in a rival federation and he wasn't allowed into the IFBB again until many years later. Well, actually, Sergio did compete in 73 the next year. He won the IFBB Mr. International contest, which was held in Tijuana, Mexico. And I have a chapter about that event in my book, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends, Volume 1. I call it the Tijuana Incident, because Sergio won the contest, but he also challenged Arnold to come up on stage and pose down with him in Mexico. And Arnold was in the audience with Joe Weider, and Joe Weider wouldn't let Arnold go up there. And then only about 3 weeks later, Arnold won the 1973 Mr. Olympia, and Sergio was a no-show. And that's a shame, because that was also the event that Charles Gaines and George Butler covered for the book Pumping Iron. So you can imagine, if Sergio would have went into that contest, I'm sure he would have been included in the book. And then who knows, maybe they would have asked him to be in the movie too. So just a shame Sergio stopped competing, but he never felt Joe Weider was being fair to him. And that's why he never came back until 1984. And by then he was kind of past his peak. Chris Widener says, I always enjoy these podcasts or these videos. It's all the best to you, for you and yours in the new year. And then Lee Baptiste said, hi, John. Happy New Year. Hope all is well. I love the Ed Corney tribute. Is it possible to get Robbie Robinson, Rick Wayne, and Muhammad McAway talking, discussing training, etc.? Thanks again. I love the show. Well, I'm still working on Robbie. He just did an interview recently with Dave Palumbo for RX Muscle, so hopefully Robbie will be able to come on our show as well. Rick Wayne I was talking to quite extensively for a while, but we kind of lost contact, so I'll try and reestablish contact with him, because he said he was interested, and I'd love to interview Rick Wayne. He had a great career in bodybuilding, not only as a bodybuilder, but also as a writer for Joe Weider's magazine. Unfortunately, Muhammad McAway said he is not interested in talking at all. He made that very clear. I don't know why, but that's a shame, because he was such a great champion. So thank you for all the emails. I really appreciate your input, guys. If you want to email me, you can reach me on Facebook, you can reach me on YouTube, or you can just email me directly at naturalolympia@gmail.com. I'm always interested to hear what you guys have to say about the show. And I think I am going to introduce those articles, maybe, as Scott said, once every 2 or 3 weeks. I'll read another article, because I've got all these old muscle builders around, and they got some really, really good articles in there. So why not share them with you guys? I'm sure a lot of people never have access to these magazines because they're 40 or 50 years old. So I have them here, and people aren't going to see them anyway. So I might as well just share them with you guys by reading an article now and then. And I think it would really go well with the format of the show. Speaking of my training is still really going good. I'm trying to, I'm in the off season now, and my strength is going up every week. I'm still staying lean. I'm only about 210, so I'm only about 10 pounds heavier than I was for my photo shoot, keeping my waist about 34 and a quarter or 34 and a half, and I think I got down to 33 for my photo shoot. So it's about an inch and a half bigger than it was, but I still look pretty lean. I want to stay lean as much as I can, so I've been counting up my calories, trying to figure out what my maintenance level is, and I think about 3,000 calories is about right for me as far as the calories go. Maybe a little bit higher once in a while, go up to 4,000 or 3,500. So I'm still playing with it, still trying to figure it out, but it's going good. My training's going good. My legs are getting bigger, which was my the area I wanted to really concentrate on. So everything's going great with that. In fact, I'm going to try and get some training videos up on YouTube. I shot a couple already. I shot a leg training video and a shoulder training video. So I'm going to try and shoot some more. And these are actual training videos. And I'm going to try and put those up on YouTube. It's just hard to do all this video editing while I'm working full time and everything. My time is limited, but I'm really going to try and work hard to do more editing from this point forward and get some more stuff on YouTube, because I know a lot of people go on the YouTube channel. And that's a big place to get some content out there in addition to these podcasts. All right, before we get to our interview with Jerry Branum, I also want to mention that we're brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also are comfortable in knowing that they are there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida at 813-922-8939, or you can reach them on their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. And if you mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they will give you a free consultation, plus they'll give you 20% off your first order. So again, their number is 813-922-8939, or their website, flalternativemeds.com. All right, so here is our interview with the always entertaining Jerry Branum, where we talk about the year 1978. Enjoy.
All right, Jerry, let's jump ahead 10 years now. We'll go to 1978. So okay. By this time, Arnold is retired, of course. He was Mr. Olympia six times, and then he came back in 1980, of course. But by 1978, Frank Zane was the reigning Mr. Olympia, and that year he won his second Mr. Olympia in 1978.
Right.
And he beat out Robbie Robinson and Roy Callender and Boyer Coe and Cal Scalak and Danny Padilla. So he had an all-star lineup there.
Well, the thing about Frank was, similarly to what I said earlier about his 1968 win over Arnold in the IPB Universe, Frank was a master at finishing. What I mean by that is he'd come into a contest completely peaked.
Yeah.
Now that 78 contest you're talking about, Robbie, if you went purely by muscle mass, Robbie should have won.
Yeah.
Robbie should have won. But Robbie had a problem in those days because he would look really great about, let's say, a week before the show. He'd look unbeatable. But by the night of the show, he just wasn't at 100% peak, and Frank was.
Mm-hmm.
That Frank was able to defeat him. Frank was and the thing about Frank that stands out in my mind that I remember, because I used to see him train at the original Golds. I actually lived next door to him for a year in Santa Monica, next apartment, and you know, I knew him very well. And the thing about Frank was that he, if you saw him, this is like a standing joke in the gym. 2 weeks before a major show, whether it's a Universe or Olympia, he didn't look great. I mean, the guy looked smooth. Hmm. I mean, he looked small. I didn't want to insult Frank, but I used to say, I'd look at him, I'd say, he's got a contest in 2 weeks. He looks like crap. How's he going to win?
Wow.
But, you know, then he kind of disappeared for a couple of days. And then you'd see him at the contest, and he was in 100% peak shape.
Hmm.
They gave him the nickname the Chemist because of that.
Right.
They thought he had this secret ability to suddenly get in shape literally overnight. and that's the thing that always I told you the story about the me and Frank's trophies, right? Did I tell you that in a previous podcast?
No, I don't think so, no.
Oh, it's a kind of funny story. What happened was, like I said, I lived next door to Frank Zane. I believe it was I think it was 1969 that year.
Okay.
And Frank, after about a year, he was going to move. And he had all the trophies he won were in his living room. You know, he had Mr. Universe, Mr. International, all this and that. You know, of course, the Mr. America. It was that kind of that six-foot trophy, really
yeah.
big trophy. And he said to me, he says, hey, Jerry, could you do me a favor? He says, could you hold my trophies for a couple of days while me and Christine, his wife, you know, we get settled in a new place. I said, sure, Frank. Remember, I was literally next door. It was easy to carry the trophies right
yeah,
in.
Yeah.
So he carried, you know, I helped him. We carried all these trophies, put it in my living room, you know, and they're sitting there. And I was going to, at the time, I was going to Santa Monica College. And I remember there was a young girl, and she had missed a couple of classes. She asked me if I had notes for the classes that she missed. I said, yeah, I have them back at my place. You want to follow me over? And I'll give you the notes, you know. She said, sure. I didn't know this girl, you know.
Yeah.
I was just, you know, so she follows me over and, you know, I open the door.
And there's all the trophies.
So you walk in the bedroom, the apartment, the first thing you see is these, what, maybe 20, 30, 25 trophies.
Right.
All varying in size. You had the ornate Mr. International, looked like a sculpture. You had the sweat shirt. So she starts to read the, you know, the little plates on the phone. She's Mr. America, Mr. International, Mr. Universe. She says, are these your trophies? And I looked at her and said, it's my apartment, isn't it? And, you know, and it looked like kind of feasible because I was still competing in those days. So I was in good shape. I was, you know, yeah. I was lean.
Yeah.
You could see that I worked out. There was right. no question. She was awed, and she was actually almost afraid of me, you know, and she just, I gave her the notes and she literally ran out the But the funniest thing was, the funniest part, the thing related to that was the same year, I think it was, Arnold, Frank, and Frank Zane and Franco Colombo, they all wanted to practice their posing together. So they knew that I lived by myself, you know, and they said, Jerry, could we set up a posing light in your living room where we could practice the posing, right? And of course, I knew them all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I consider them friends. I said, sure, why not? You know, yeah. I mean, I'm at school most of the time. You know, and, you know, Frank could let himself in and they could practice. So sure enough, this time another student, you know, came over my place, you know, right after school. And I put the key in the door. And the first thing she sees is Arnold Schwarzenegger, Franco Colombo, and Frank Zane all standing there in their posing trunks.
Right.
I don't remember whether they had oil on or not, but I remember she took one look at these three extremely muscular giant guys. Her eyes got very wide, like they moved stuff, and she just didn't say anything. She literally ran down the stairs and ran into.
Oh my God!
We all had a good laugh at that. I wish I had video in those days. That would have been a great video.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That would have been classic.
Yeah. That was really funny.
So Frank's key to winning then was he was just more ripped than everybody else, right?
Ripped and finished, yeah. He was also a very good poser. He was able to hide. Again, I think we've discussed in the past when we talked about Larry Scott that – you know, the key to winning a major show is not just having the muscles of definition, but the display is important because, as I said earlier, no man is perfect and everybody has weak points. So a smart bodybuilder will pose in such a way that his weak points are minimized.
Yeah.
Now, Frank didn't have great arms, you know, and a double on bicep. You know, it's not that his arms are very bad, but they didn't look big.
Yeah.
But he had a tricep shot.
Yeah.
So, for example, when he posed, he would, you know, he'd do a shot like this, and he'd, you know, the side tricep like that. He would emphasize the triceps because his tricep was extremely developed.
Yeah.
And he'd also always, another smart thing he did, he always kept his thighs flexed. So his thighs looked really ripped. He never relaxed them because if he'd relaxed them, they wouldn't have looked as cut. So he gave the overall impression was this guy is really in shape. Look at him. He's got everything.
Yeah.
He's cut. There's no weak points.
Yeah.
He did have weak points, but Frank was smart enough through his posing to hide them. And that was another reason why he won those three Mr. Olympia and, you know, the rest of the contest.
Yeah.
Frank was a smart guy. He knew what to, you know, still is.
Yeah, the bodybuilders are so big nowadays. When you read the message boards, people are just, like the younger kids, they just can't believe someone like Frank Zane could win Mr. Olympia. But I was at all three of his Mr. Olympias, and I thought he deserved every one. I mean, he looked like the winner to me. You know, he was ripped. He knew, like you said, he knew how to present himself, and he didn't look small on stage when he was up there.
Because remember, Frank, I mean, I've been telling this himself. Frank had one of the keys, and he shared this with Flex Wheeler. They both had very small bones.
Yeah.
Now, normally that would be, now Frank told me he had 6-inch wrists. That's a very small wrist for a man who was 5'9", I believe he was. And the thing is, when you have small bones, you know this is true, John, you're at a bit of disadvantage to putting muscle size on.
Yeah.
It's a little harder if you're small bone to put muscle size on. But if you can, the effect is very dramatic. For example, Frank, because of the small bones, his waist looked very small, and he had a beautiful waist-shoulder-lat ratio. In other words, like when he stood relaxed, he would turn slightly to the side, and his shoulders would look very wide.
Yeah.
So as you said, it gave the impression that he was bigger. I mean, the man was, what, 185 pounds?
When
he I mean, he could pass for like 200 pounds.
Yeah.
But you know, because he knew how to, like, hold, you know, the way he stood, again, having that tiny waist. And the same for Flex Wheeler. Not that Flex wasn't big. He was huge. But flex because of, he was. If you look at photos of him, he was a very skinny guy when he started, and he always had that very small hips and waist, and made the rest of them look that much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kind of almost like an illusion effect.
Yeah.
So that's another key to Frank's season. And I agree with you. There was no doubt in my mind. He definitely deserved to win all three of those. Like you say, the young guys today, they see these massive monsters.
Yeah.
God help them if they ever look go back even further. The guys in the 50s and the 40s.
Right, right.
I've had arguments online with some of these guys where, you know, I knew Reg Park very well. I got to know him in later years quite well. And, he talked about old training and what he did, and he's very adamantly against steroids. And Reg in his youth was a very, very strong guy. He was one of the first guys to bench press 500 pounds. And these guys would look at photos of Reg when he was bulky, and he was big. I mean, if you look at him in the Hercules, he was a pretty big guy. He was Arnold's inspiration.
Yeah.
Reg Park was Arnold's idol, you know?
Right, right. And
these guys, you can't get that big without steroids. I'd say, look. If I didn't know Reg, maybe I'd wonder myself. But I knew this guy, and I'm telling you, this guy hated steroids. This guy would never. You could put a gun through his head, and he wouldn't take a steroid.
Yeah.
I said, very strong was different back then.
Yeah.
The guys being very heavy. I mean, I remember talking to Clarence Ross. Of course, you don't remember.
Yeah.
And Clarence told me. I said, if there's one thing you do over again, what would you change? He says, I wouldn't have trained as heavy as I did for as long as I did. Because now I'm an older man, I'm more crippled up, I have to have a walker. I mean, that's how they trained in those days, very heavy weights, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the guys today, and I've seen them, I got to tell you, I've seen videos of Phil training. These guys don't lift heavy weights compared to guys years ago.
They don't train hard.
I mean, they're massive, there's no question about it, but I mean, it's almost like they don't have real muscle there. It's almost like air-filled muscle.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's not because the guys years ago, that muscle was built with heavy weights, and you know how you can tell the difference? You remember the great John Grimmick, who
was the only
man to win Mr. America twice. I think it was 41 and 42.
Yeah.
But this guy, I remember reading something where, and I did meet him a couple of times too, but he wrote that there's been occasions where, get this, John, he didn't train for like a year, no nothing, no weight training, and yet he lost very little muscle.
Yeah.
Why? Because his muscle was real. He was an Olympic lifter too. It was built with heavy weights. Here's a factoid for you. If you never heard this before, this is going to shock you. The great Steve Reeves, who even today, all right, he wasn't a monster like these guys, but even today, everyone agrees. Clarence Ross told me that Steve Reeves had the most beautiful body he ever saw, and Clarence Ross beat him twice in contest.
Wow.
Anyone today would look at Steve Reeves when he was a bodybuilder and say, that is a fantastic body. Small waist, beautiful, and very handsome guy. I mean, you know, Steve Reeves said, remember when he did the Hercules movies, and if you look at those movies, they were made in 1957, but they weren't released till 59. If you look at him, he was in great shape. He looked like a bodybuilder. I mean, he was Hercules.
Yeah.
He said that he only trained, when those movies were made, get this, he only trained 1 month out of the year. 1 month. That's
wow.
it.
Out of the year.
Out of the year, and he looked like that. Could you imagine these guys today, if they trained 1 month out of the year, what they would look like?
Yeah.
So my point is, these guys had real muscle.
Right.
You know?
Real
and
physique.
I'm not, and I know it sounds like I'm being very critical of the guys today. I'm not. I mean, in a way, like I say, we're all bodybuilders. I admire their muscle mass. I could take a million steroids and never look like these guys.
Right.
They're freaks. I mean, they have everything, you know, but it's just like a different type of time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So guys that criticize, you know, the people years, you know, like you said, Frank saying they think looks skinny, all that. They don't have the sense of history. They don't understand how it was.
Right.
They don't see what they see today, you know, so there's no comparison in their minds for them. So that's why they act like that.
Yeah. The other story too from that 1978 Mr. Olympia was Cal Skalak, who got fifth, and he did the crucifix pose on stage, and then he was pretty much done with the IFBB after that.
Well, you know what happened with Cal? I knew Cal pretty well. You know, Cal, he first came up from Gold. I can't remember where he came from.
Delaware.
Where was it?
Delaware.
Delaware. Yeah, he was living out of his van for the first couple of months,
yeah.
training at Colts. And I remember I used to have like a little friendly rivalry with this guy. He was bigger than me in the upper body, but it was almost like I was thinking about Zane. I was more fit. I thought I was more finished than him. I was much harder than he was when he first showed up. And I remember him talking about how he was going to go in the Mr. California. I think it was the same year he won the America. What year was that? That was that
76.
76.
Yeah.
And I said to him, you know, his legs were really bad to me. He had terrible legs. And I said to him, I said, hey, Cal, you know, because he was very boastful. You know, he always talked about, you know, how great he was and this and that. And I said, hey, Cal, you know what? I'm going to compete against you in the California this year, and I'm going to beat you because your legs stink. I said, you got a bigger upper body, but I got legs. I said, I'm going to beat you. As it is, I didn't compete against him that year. He did win the California, and he went on to win the
America, right.
It didn't prove, you know.
Yeah.
But what happened to Cal was a very outspoken guy. I mean, this is a guy who took no guff from anybody.
Right.
In fact, I had a run-in with him right around that time, right around the time of that Olympia. He used to, like, try and start off with me in the gym. You know, he'd say things and you know, try and get me going, you know, and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he just wouldn't stop. He kept saying, you know, I said, Cal, enough already. Enough, man. And so he said it again. I said, and I took him aside where nobody could hear, you know. And I said, look, Cal, you're a big, strong guy. I said, but, you know, I've had it with you. I said, if you want, we'll go in the alley and we'll finish this right now. I said, because I've asked you nicely to just stop the crap. I said, stop with this. And he goes like this. He says, I didn't know that you took it so seriously, Jerry. I apologize. And he shook my hand and we became friends. We were friends after that. He never said stuff to me again.
Well, but here's what was he saying to you to get you going?
Oh, well, he was saying stuff like, you need to train your skinny arms that kind of stuff. Hey Jerry, you know, why don't you try and compete against me again? You know, blah blah. You know, you'll place last. This kind of stuff. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it didn't really bother me, but he just wouldn't stop. You know, it was like, I wasn't so thin skinned that I would get mad if somebody says I have skinny arms. Who cares? You know.
Yeah.
I know that he was trying to get to me because that's the way he was. But it was just incessant, and I couldn't take it after a while. I was trying to focus on my training. This guy's yelling across the gym, you know? So what happened was, though, like Cal was, like I say, a very, I don't know if you want to call him arrogant, but, you know, what happened was he didn't like the way the bodybuilders were being treated. You know, the fact that, you know, they were, you know, used on the covers and they were used in all these ads and Joe Weider wouldn't pay him anything and all that crap,
yeah.
You know? So he decided to form a bodybuilders union. And at first, all the guys got behind him, you know. But I remember the first guy who broke ranks was Tom Platz.
Okay.
And then, of course, Arnold wouldn't fall in line because, you know, he was close with Joe. He wouldn't support the union. And more or less, to make a long story short, everybody kind of turned against Cal. So Cal was kind of, you know, on his own.
Yeah.
And this all happened right before that Olympia with the crucifix thing.
Right.
So what Cal figured was that he deserved much higher than fifth place, but the fifth place was a payback because he tried to start the union.
Right.
That's what he meant by the crucifix. In other words, they crucified him because he tried to help the other bodybuilders.
Right.
Of course, we know the rest of the story. Cal eventually, you know, I think not long after he quit bodybuilding, he went into cycling, you know,
yeah.
He became a cyclist, and he did actually quite well. He dropped his body weight down to something like 170 pounds.
Right.
In fact, I saw a photo of him where he got second in an over 50, not long ago, over 50 cycling contests. He was wearing the cycling shorts, still had the bad calves, but for some reason, he decided to do a bicep pose while he was standing on the platform.
Right.
They're giving him the awards. And I looked, Cal had great arms.
Yeah.
Almost like an Arnold type of arm.
Right.
And I remember looking at him when he flexed his arm there on the bicycle awards plate, and just like a little peanut now. I mean, it still had the same bicep shape,
right.
But it was now shrunken. It looked like maybe a 14, 15 inch arm.
Right.
Just a little, looked like a little bean sitting on his arm there.
Right.
But
right.
He still had the bicep peak though, the famous. Cal Scalic Peak was still there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess he was just kind of like bring back a little memory of his bodybuilding days when he did that, you know.
And didn't he take some photos from Joe Weider's office?
Yeah, I think I heard about that. I never followed that through, though.
Yeah.
He had a lot of antipathy against Joe and Ben Weider and the whole thing. And he was just disgusted. He thought bodybuilding was very political, very unfair. Mm-hmm. And he felt that he didn't like the way bodybuilders are treated, so he quit. He just quit the whole thing.
Yeah.
He did train and stayed fairly, big for a couple of years. I ran into him at a couple of shows after he stopped competing, and he was still in good shape. And then, I don't remember how many years after he stopped competing, that's when he decided to swim all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had a conversation about it. I think he told me that he felt that carrying a lot of weight, a lot of muscle was not good for your health as you aged.
Okay.
So he purposely slimmed down. I don't know whether he became a vegan. I don't remember what he did, but I remember he slimmed down quite a bit. And of course, that's when he got into the cycling and the competition. And I saw another guy do that many years before. If you remember a bodybuilder named Bill McArdle, who was around
Gym guys. I remember that name.
Yeah, he won the Cal. He was a very handsome guy. Also a good friend of Larry Scott. I think they were even roommates for a while.
Okay.
But I met him a couple of times. Very, very nice guy. Unfortunately, very sadly, he died of AIDS many years ago. But super nice guy, though. What a nice guy. But I remember running into him. Frank Zane and his wife, we all went to one of those, like a Zen Buddhist thing they were having at the Santa Monica Auditorium. I was living next door to Frank, and we all went over there, to Santa Monica Auditorium. And who do I run into? There's Bill McArdle. I recognized him, right? He was a bodybuilder, And this is a couple of years later. And he was like, John, he was bone thin.
Wow.
He was emaciated,
Yeah.
Now, in retrospect, maybe it was because he was dying. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I looked at him and I said, Bill, I said, I mean, what happened? I mean, did you quit training? He says, yeah. He says, I quit training and I became a vegan. He said, and that's all he said. I said, well, again, I shook hands and I walked away. Uh-huh. Always a nice. I really, when I heard that he died, I felt really bad. He was such a person. You would have liked him. He was the friendliest guy you could imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
Guy had like movie star looks too. Man. Very handsome. Hmm. Very handsome guy. Yeah, yeah. There was another guy like that named John. Oh, what was his name? He won the Cal. I can't remember this guy. Oh, I can't remember. John Corvell? You ever hear John Corvell?
Yeah, yeah. I remember that name, too.
Yeah, he won the Cal. Again, this guy looked like a movie star. A very handsome guy. Women would go crazy over this guy.
Wow.
And a fantastic physique, beautiful abs. I met him, too. He went to work at a gym for a guy named Terry Robinson,
mm-hmm.
who was also a bodybuilder from the 40s, who had a gym in Century City. John became a trainer over there, and I got very friendly with John. Great guy, terrific guy, and I think he did try to, I don't know whether he tried to become an actor or not, but I remember looking at this guy thinking, this guy could be a movie actor, man. He's very handsome, very handsome. I mean, when I walked out, we had lunch one day, I remember going into the restaurant, every woman in the place was staring at this guy. Literally every woman in the place. That's how good looking he was.
Wow.
I remember in shape, remember?
Yeah.
He always, this guy was literally women's dreams physically.
Yeah, right, right.
The only other time I saw something comparable to that was the year that what was his name? Who was the guy that he came out as gay in your
Bob Paris.
Bobby Paris.
Yeah.
But the year that Bob Paris won the America, during the in between the prejudging and the finals, we all went to a restaurant, and I was sitting at another table with Artie Zeller, the photographer, a couple other guys, and he hadn't come out yet. What's his name again?
Bob Paris.
Bob Paris. He hadn't come out yet, and out of the closet, what do you want to call it?
Yeah.
And so he was sitting at the table with his boyfriend, actually. But he was, again, remember, he won the show that year. He was very tan,
yeah,
very handsome guy. And all the women in the restaurant, same deal, were all staring at him.
Yeah.
Right?
He was a good-looking guy, yeah.
And I turned to Artie Zeller, and I said, Artie, I said, not one woman in this place is looking at us. They're all looking at us. And, it's hilarious that, you know, he has no interest in them whatsoever.
Right, right.
And we all started laughing about that.
Right.
You know? But it's a great guy too, though. I've never cared about the homosexual.
Yeah.
I don't judge people. That's their personal life, you know.
Right.
I judge people as they treat me. And Bob Parris is a terrific guy. And, you know, I know, again, super body. What a physique this guy.
Oh, yeah.
Great physique. I mean, talking about Tom Thibodeau, he was almost like a bigger Frank Zane.
Yeah.
He was like Frank Zane with more muscle size.
Right, right.
It was the best. He was a great poser.
Yeah.
Very intelligent guy. You know, went on to write a couple of books. Very smart guy.
Yeah.
Always, when I interviewed, very literate, smart guy. Always had that deep voice, you know. Always a very smart guy, you know. I wish him well, wherever he is.
Hey, I want to go back to Cal, because I want to ask you a question about the steroids back then, Jerry. Because I remember when I was starting bodybuilding in Muscle Builder magazine, Cal was talking about how he didn't take drugs. Any drugs from when he won the America in 76 until when he won the Universe. And he said he stayed off for a long period of time. And I've talked to a lot of guys, bodybuilders from the 70s and stuff, and they said they all did it sort of similar to that. Is that true? Is that how the bodybuilders did the steroids back then?
It's very true. Very true. In fact, Arnold, believe it or not, people find this hard to believe. Arnold only began using steroids 3 months before a show.
Yeah.
As soon as the show was over, he'd get off of that. All the guys did that. Nobody stayed up steroids all the time. A couple of guys did, I have to admit, though, did what is common today. I can't remember the expression they used, but it basically involves staying on very low doses of steroids year-round. There's a certain expression for it. I can't
cruising,
remember.
Cruising? Is it cruising?
And maybe it might be cruising, yeah. Cruising, by the way, used to be a homosexual
right,
term.
Right. Because Al Pacino was in that movie, remember?
But the point is, I think that's what it might be. But in other words, some guys, you know, still do that today. But, you know, that was a rarity back then. The guys would take, and as I've said, you know, before, the steroid cycles back then were laughable compared to what they are today.
Yeah.
I mean, they'd average maybe one or two injections and maybe two orals. And the doses were very conservative, very low. I mean, like, for example, one of the more popular oral steroids, methandrostenolone, also known as Dianabol, the blue pill, was, the guys would take maybe 5 to 7 a day. That was, it was a 5-milligram pill. That's a pretty good amount.
Yeah.
But compared to what guys would take today, it was minuscule.
Yeah.
The only thing I ever saw take more than that was a famous bodybuilder from the early 60s named Freddie Ortiz. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
Yeah, sure. Great arms.
One of the best arms ever. Arnold himself told me that Freddie Ortiz had better arms than him. Could you imagine? Arnold said that.
Yeah.
I witnessed Freddie at a gym called Mid-City Health Club in New York. I saw Freddie Ortiz open a locker, take out a bottle of Dianabol. I could read the bottle. I didn't know what Dianabol was. I was 14 years old.
All right.
And I remember he opened the bottle. It was a new bottle. And he tilted his head back. And he went like this. He just poured the bottle in his mouth.
Unbelievable.
Had like 100 tablets in there, right?
Yeah.
So I had a good friend of mine who was a bodybuilder, also a bodyguard, training a guy named John Romeo, his name was. And I was 14. I didn't even know what steroids were. So I went up to John Romeo. I said, Freddie Ortiz, by the way, was a very intimidating guy. He was a Puerto Rican guy, didn't speak much English, but he always seemed like he was angry about something. I saw him get angry at another Puerto Rican guy and started to beat him up, chase him into the street in Manhattan, and keep punching him as they were running down the street.
Jeez.
So I was a kid. He scared me, Freddie Ortiz. I would never talk to him.
Yeah.
So I went to John Romeo, and I said, hey, John, I just saw this guy, Freddie Ortiz. It was about something called Dianabol, and he poured the whole bottle in his mouth. I said, what is Dianabol, John? He says, that's the stuff that gave Freddie his arms. <That's always, laughs> Wow. And walked away quizzical. I said, wait a minute. Does the pill go in his arm and make you? I couldn't figure it. You know, it took me a couple of years to understand how steroids work. I mean, I was 14 years old. You know? But I mean, I'll never forget how he just poured it in his mouth. I said, hold on, Toledo.
Right.
I've never seen that. I mean, but like I say, you know, getting back to the steroids, it was very conservative. Arnold, he used a His favorite steroid was an injection called Primobolan. He got it straight from the shearing comb. Believe it or not, he had contacts in Germany. Remember, he lived in Munich for a while.
Yeah.
Where they get it direct, and it was different in those days. It didn't have all the. It was much easier to take, you know, get steroid. He had I don't know whether the guy worked for the company, some guy from the shearing company who manufactured Primobolan would send him the drugs right from Germany. So there was no black market crap.
No, right.
He got the real pure stuff.
Right.
And I remember he favored, there was a 100-milligram injection. I think they discontinued it a couple of years later. But I actually saw, you know, that was his favorite steroid.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he used Decadrablin. He would take a little bit of thyroid. And Frank also was also big on thyroid. Mm-hmm. That's another thing the guys did in those days. I guess they still do it today. I know that the fitness and the some of the women actually to use thyroid to lose body fat. But in those days, most of the guys did use thyroid up to the show. Frank favored a more natural form, which still exists today, called Armour Thyroid, which was actually extracted from pig thyroid glands. And Frank was ahead of his time because, unlike the pharmaceutically pure thyroid drugs such as Cytomel or T3 and levothyroxine, which is, what's the name of it? I can't remember the trade name. That's T4. But the point is, those are synthetic, but they're two different thyroid hormones, right? The active one's T3. But the Armour Thyroid, being natural, had all the natural thyroid hormones in the right proportion.
Wow.
So what did that mean? That means that you could take this particular form of thyroid, and it would help you lose body fat, but you wouldn't lose any muscle. The problem with taking Cytomel, for example, which is the most powerful thyroid, T3, is if you took too much, you burned your muscles away like nothing.
Right.
I remember Serge Noubre brought over this stuff, what was it called? Triacana. He brought in this stuff from France one year, the original Golds, and Ken Wall, all the guys, France, he said, remember, Serge Noubre had a fantastic physique. Again, tiny, tiny waist. He had that rare combination of a very small waist and deep, deep abs.
Yeah.
He would do hundreds of reps of ab work a day, which was crazy.
Right.
But that's what he did, you know. Anyway, he came over one year and he said to all the guys, he says, they said, well, how do you get so hard? How do you get that look? He says, I take this special thyroid drug, Triacana. He says, you guys want to try it? So they said, Bill Brennan, I remember, Ken Walla, and maybe, I don't know if Arnold did, but a couple other guys tried it. And they asked Serge Noubre the dosage, and he told them to take 15 a day, right? And they did it. I remember Bill, because I was doing some training with Bill Grant then. Remember he had those big arms?
Oh, yeah. Still does.
Some started to shrink. And he's freaking out because Bill is another guy who's a naturally skinny guy,
Yeah.
His muscles were disappearing. He couldn't figure it out. Now, back then, I didn't know as much about pharmacology as I do now. But even back then, I knew that too much thyroid could have a catabolic effect on muscles.
Right.
Say, Bill, you got to get off that Triacana stuff right now, man. It's breaking down. And I told Waller and I told the other guys. And Bill was a close friend, so I said this to him. I didn't say it to the other guy. I said, I don't know what Serge Noubre is up to, why he's telling you guys, but I have a funny feeling he's trying to make you guys look like crap so he can win the contest.
Sure, right.
Serge Noubre is no friend of you. I said, of you guys. I said, but it was a funny story because the thing is, if you had taken that particular thyroid drug, that was kind of a precursor to T3.
Yeah.
In other words, it's the strongest eating. If you took it in small amounts, it probably would have been okay.
Yeah.
But you start taking 15 tablets a day, you're going to have problems. Yeah. I mean, the worst scenario thing about thyroid is it can really hit your heart very hard. This is why doctors give out levothyroxine. Again, I can't remember the name for some reason, the trade name. Because it's a thyroid prohormone. It's T4, it's called. It's slowly converted into the active T3 form over, let's say, 5 to 7 days. So it doesn't really hit your heart hard. And doctors are always afraid of thyroid hormone affecting people's hearts because a lot of people walk around with problems with their heart that don't even know it.
Right.
If they take something like thyroid, if it's too strong, it might push them over the edge and give them a heart attack. So
that's not
about this thyroid drug, you know. But so, you know, getting back to, they took Armathyroid. Some of the guys, I believe Arnold did take Cynomel T3,
mm-hmm.
but he took a pretty small amount. I think it was, it's like 25 milligrams. I think he never took more than 2 tablets a day.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And contrary to rumors, and I've heard this and read it, nobody took growth hormone back then. That's BS.
Yeah.
Growth hormone, the only growth hormone available back then was obtained from cadavers. You know, they didn't have the synthetic growth hormone didn't appear until, I believe, it was 1985.
Okay.
You know, and the problem with the cadaver, we didn't know it back then, but the cadaver-based growth hormone could possibly contain these substances called prions, which in turn could cause a disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which basically destroys your brain, pokes holes in your brain, like it makes it look like Swiss cheese.
Jeez.
So you have a slow, lingering, miserable death. This often occurs years after you've used the growth hormone. So my point is, I'm happy that the guys didn't use growth hormone.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason why is very simple. And what we didn't know about Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. I don't think prions were even discovered back then. But the reason they didn't use it was very simple. It was very hard to get.
Right.
Because they had to, remember, they had to take it from dead bodies, as cadavers. So there was a limited supply, and the only growth hormone available was used to treat medical conditions like dwarfism.
Yeah.
It wasn't terrible. I admit, I won't be in full disclosure, if the bodybuilders could have gotten their hands on growth hormone, they probably would have used it.
Yeah.
Just a mere sound. Growth hormone.
Right.
What bodybuilder is going to not want to use growth hormone?
right. Well, that's interesting to hear about the steroids. Do you think Arnold, when he came over to America and he was really big, do you think also he was just taking them 3 months before a show, or was he taking them more then?
I think that Arnold, for the first couple of years, actually took them. I think actually did take it more than before kind of. I think he took low doses. He was one of those low dose year round guys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But came over here, he increased the dosages. But he used it for a more limited time. In other words, rather than take small dosages year-round, because Arnold back in Europe felt that the steroids, he needed to take the steroids all the time to stay big. And he was big. Well, if you look at photos of as a young man when he came in, he was a big guy for his age.
Right. Oh, yeah, huge.
And he felt that without the steroids, he couldn't keep that size. So he stayed on something like Dianabol, fairly, you know, maybe 3 a day, something like that. Very conservative.
Yeah.
Probably some Primobol and acetate, you know, year round. He got away with it. He was a young guy. It didn't really mess him up. But once he kind of matured, he came over here, you know, and he kind of like learned how the American bodybuilders use steroids. That's when he kind of more or less duplicated their plan
mm-hmm.
of youth, let's say maybe 3 months before a contest, then getting off it. And I'll tell you, you know he got off it because when all the guys, Frank and Arnold, all the guys back then, I mean, if you saw them 3 months after the contest, you couldn't imagine that they had just won major titles.
Right.
Arnold's physique would literally disappear. All he had left 3 months after a show, he never lost that big bicep. And for some reason, his calves always stayed big. And the reason for that was Arnold would slack off on his training a couple of months after the show. He'd come in and do like 20-minute workouts maybe 3 or 4 times a week.
Okay.
He didn't train that hard. But the thing I noticed about him, and I always remember, for some reason, he always trained his calves hard all the time. He drove maybe 15 sets of calves all year round. And I think it's because calves were so hard to get for Arnold.
Right.
And he didn't want to get it. Didn't want to take a chance of losing them.
Yeah.
Same reason he took the steroids back in Europe. He didn't want to take a chance of losing the muscle. See?
Right.
So,
right.
You know, but, you know, the thing is, in retrospect, it was actually a smart thing to do. I didn't realize it at the time, but by kind of like gliding through most of the year, just using a kind of keep in shape maintenance program, when the contest time came around, let's say 3 months before a show, they can rev it up and their bodies, because they had rested and gotten off the drugs, their bodies would respond tremendously to the drugs.
Right.
And they would just blow up in like 3 weeks. Danny Padilla, used to come in from Rochester, New York, a little short guy with no muscle, a little tiny guy.
Mm-hmm.
He'd start training at Gold's, and in 4 weeks, he'd look like he did in the photos. He looked like Miss Universe. 4 weeks.
Yeah, 4 weeks. Wow.
Took the Universe body in 4 weeks.
Jeez.
Because, again, he didn't train back in New York. He worked at his father's, I think he had some sort of grocery store.
Grocery store, yeah.
And he didn't take the drugs. And, you know, so when he got back on him and when he started training, his body just responded tremendously, see?
Yeah.
So and all the guys like that. Sure, they did a lot of shape. You know, if you look back at photos back then, you see when they did the posing exhibitions, they were all smooth and they were smooth.
Right, right, yeah. I've seen that. I'll
give you a good example. You can check this out. Look at the photos of when Arnold, Frank Zane, and who was the other? There was one or two other guys. They posed at the Whitney Museum right around the time.
Ed Corning. Yeah.
Ed Corning. Look at... Ed Corning was in decent shape then, but if you look at Arnold and Frank when they posed at that museum, anyone can go online and look it up. Look at their physiques. Look how different they look.
Yeah.
Arnold, smooth. He hardly had any pecs.
Yeah.
Still had arms, you know.
Yeah.
But his legs were almost non-existent.
Right.
Frank was uncharacteristically smooth.
Right.
Could barely see his abs.
Right.
I mean, this, if you want to see what they look like, in between contests, when they were doing this maintenance program I talked about, that's what they look like. That's a perfect example. That's what they look like.
And that was 3 months after they filmed Pumping Iron. Pumping Iron was in November of 75. That was in February of 76. So that was only 3 months later.
And, you know, when Arnold made that movie, what was the one where where he played the violin? What was the name of that movie?
Stay Hungry.
Stay Hungry. The director... felt that Arnold, I think if I remember correctly, that was actually filmed. Arnold was not that big. It was filmed when he was off season.
Yeah, it was filmed in the spring of 75 before the Olympia. Yeah.
Right. And Arnold was not as big as he was in the contest or not as cut, but the director.
Yeah. He was only 210, I think.
Right. But the director told Arnold that, you know, you're still too big for the camera. You're going to make all the other actors look too small. It's going to look artificial.
Yeah.
So I'd like to drop about another 10 pounds. So that movie, Arnold, you know, dropped another 10 pounds.
Yeah.
And he was really small for that movie, you know.
Right.
But here's the funny part. As you point out, the Olympia was coming up right after that. And Arnold, sure enough, as soon as finished the movie, came back to Gold's Gym. Went back into his pre-contest training steroid program. And in 6 weeks, I remember it was about 6 weeks, Arnold looked like the champion we all know. I
mean, right.
He transformed himself from a guy who probably couldn't get last place in Mr. Olympia to a clear-cut winner of Mr. Olympia in 6 weeks.
Unbelievable. That's interesting to know because I've always heard people say that. And, of course, the young kids today would never believe it. You know, they didn't believe that these guys only took them for 3 months. You know, they were off them the rest of the year.
That's all they did. That's all they did. And you know what, John? I think that's a reason why, a major reason why, again, this is speculation on my part,
mm-hmm.
why these guys are in fairly good health today. I mean,
yeah,
Frank,
sure.
He's 74, 75 years old. I mean, sure, he doesn't have the muscle. You can't expect a man 75 years old to look like he did when he was 30. But
no, yeah.
He's exercises. He's healthy as far as I know. Arnold's still, you know, healthy. I mean, they're alive.
Yeah.
Hold on. They're alive, you know, and this and that. But, I mean, I sometimes wonder. I said, are the guys today with all the heavy drug use, the guys, for example, who stay at it all year round, the so-called cruising?
Yeah.
By the way, that's a mistake, by the way. This idea that taking low amounts of steroids all year round is safe is pure nonsense.
Yeah.
Because all steroids always accumulate in the liver, and you've got to give the liver time to clear them out. You have to. Otherwise, they're going to be causing subtle, long-term liver damage. They're going to cause heart damage. All these guys that are taking these low-dose steroids, they are going to be in for trouble in a couple of years. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I hate to say it, but it's true. The guys years ago when they got off the steroids, and this has been shown in science studies, by the way, when you get off steroids, any possible change, adverse effects in your body, such as liver inflammation, adverse effects on blood lipids, they all revert back to normal. Everything reverts back to normal. As long as you know, don't take too many, and as long as you get off and give your body a rest, a chance to get off. And that's what the guys did years ago. That's why the majority of them are still alive and healthy today, you know.
Yeah.
Ed Corney had a stroke, as we both know, a couple of years ago, I guess it was. I don't know if that was related to steroids. I have no idea, honestly.
Yeah.
But apparently he's okay today from what I understand, you know, which is good. All right, Corney's a nice guy also.
Yeah. Yeah. The other big story in 78, Jerry, was the 1978 Mr. America, where Tony Pearson beat Ron Tufel, and that was pretty controversial. Ron Tufel took that really hard. He walked off the stage and everything.
Yeah, I knew both guys quite well. That was controversial because Tony Pearson, the guy who owned Gold's Gym, what was his name again?
Kent Sprague. Yeah.
The rumor was that Kent Sprague had fixed the contest for Tony Pearson.
Yeah.
Because Kent Sprague was involved somehow with the AAU or something like that. I don't remember what he did, but the standing rumor was that Kent Sprague wanted Tony to win. Not that Tony wasn't a great bodybuilder.
Right.
But, you know, that was always the rumor. However, you know, if you look at it objectively, you got to picture in your mind the two physiques. Ron Tufel was a great guy, by the way, you know, but he had a kind of blocky physique. He had a very wide, thick waist, excellent abdominal development. He had kind of very blocky thighs, no sweep to his thigh.
Right.
But very muscular. He kind of was, to me, reminiscent of an earlier form of Branch Warren.
You know,
you remember Branch Warren, very muscular but kind of always blocky looking.
Yeah.
And that's the way Ron was. Whereas, you know, Tony had the very small waist, very, very wide lats, very back, you know, and you know, not quite as thick as Ron. Objectively, again, head-to-toe body, you know, Ron had better calves than Tony, but if you look at the overall muscularity and the muscle shape and the presentation, all that, Tony deserved to win. So, you know, I mean, maybe there is some truth to that controversy. I don't know. About, you know, how it was fixed for Tony. I don't know.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, you know, having witnessed both men training for that contest at that time, I think Tony deserved to win. He was in top shape. He was, you know. Did he go on to win the NABBA Universe that year or no? Was it?
I think it was a couple of years later, yeah, because when they had the pose down for the IFBB Universe, Tom Platz beat Tony, and then Tom Platz went. Yeah.
Right, that's right. Yeah. In fact, I once saw... You mentioned Tom Platz. I saw Tony and Tom Platz train legs together.
Around
that time. And, you know, they were doing all those crazy Tom Platz squats and those weird hack squats he used to do.
Yeah.
And I remember they trained so hard that they kind of both kind of leaned. Afterwards, they leaned against the wall, and they both kind of slid down the wall and off the ground.
Wow.
They were in such pain from training legs that neither of them walked for a couple. I'll never forget that. And I always tell people now, that's intense training.
Yeah.
That's hard training. When you train your legs so hard that you have to actually sit on the ground before you can walk.
Right.
You don't see that anymore.
No. I wish they would have videotaped that workout. Man, that would have been great.
Yeah. You know, those guys train really hard. Really hard.
Speaking of the universe, Mike Mentzer won his universe that year, and he got a perfect score. That was the first 300 score in the IFBB.
Wasn't that in Mexico or something?
Yeah, Acapulco, Mexico. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. He got the perfect score. You know, Mike. I knew Mike very well. Mike again also had a head to toe body. I mean, he had a small waist. He had nice lats, good arms. I mean,
great legs.
Yeah, he had great legs. I mean, he of course was very unhappy at what happened at the 1980 Mr. Olympia.
I mean,
he felt that it was Arnold. It was a ripoff that Arnold didn't deserve the title, and he never kind of got over that, Mike Mentzer. But Mike, you know, everything that you hear about Mike, as far as you know, the intense training and the go to failure and stuff. It's all true. I mean,
really?
That's how they train. I mean, we used to have discussions of it. And unfortunately for Mike was an inherently very intelligent guy, very intelligent guy. But he had, for some reason, he had this almost pathological admiration for a guy named Arthur Jones. Do you remember Arthur Jones who invented
Nautilus,
the... You know, and Mike used to go out to DeLand, Florida, you know, And towards around that time, Mike started kind of imitating the way Arthur Jones spoke. Arthur Jones had a kind of very strong way of speaking, you know, like almost like he was commanding you or something like that.
Yeah.
And Mike started talking like that.
Huh.
So when I have these informal conversations, like we'd go out to lunch, I felt like I was sitting with Arthur Jones because I used to talk to Arthur Jones too, and I knew how he talked. And I didn't want to, like, you know, make Mike mad or point it out to him, but it was, I mean, he, you know, the guys who do 20 sets will never make any gains. They're spinning their wheel. I mean, all it sounded like Arthur Jones.
Yeah.
And if you look at online, they still have on YouTube, they have some of Mike's seminars. If you listen to his speaking style, and then you look at a video of Arthur Jones and compare them, you'll see that they're the same exact style.
Wow, that's great. I never knew that.
Yeah, in fact, Mike Munson once made a statement. He said, Arthur Jones is God.
Wow.
Which really threw me. I mean, the last time I heard anything similar to that was when John Lennon from the Beatles said that the Beatles were popular than Jesus, right. Which really troubled, you know.
Right, right.
Nobody should ever compare themselves to God. Nobody.
Right, you know? Right.
I don't care who you are. Right. That's a major mistake.
Right.
You know.
Well, I just saw an interview with Dorian, and he was saying that how much of an influence Mike Mentzer was on his philosophy of training and how he trained hard because of Mentzer, you know.
Well, you know what is, Dorian was a very kind of analytical type of guy. I mean, you could see even if you look at his current videos, he's always very analytical about everything. And he's always in for this common sense type of thing. You know, and I guess he read some of Mike's articles and it made sense. He says, why would you go to the gym and train for hours, you know, when, you know, you could just train more intensely and do fewer sets and get the same amount of results or even more results.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes sense. And what Dorian did is slightly modified his training. He didn't train exactly like Mike Mentzer. He modified it a bit, but it followed the same general principles of high intensity is paramount. High intensity is most important.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Mike, you could say that Dorian was an acolyte or a follower of Mike Mentzer. And he had a lot of admiration for Mike Mentzer. And I know that he also felt bad when Mike later on had some psychological problems.
Yeah.
You know, but Dorian is, you know, he proved his point. I mean, I remember when Dorian started to rise in bodybuilding, when other bodybuilders found out how he trained, they tried to emulate him. They tried to train the high intensity, go to failure. And I remember Aaron Baker trying it for a while, but they all quit. They just couldn't do it. It was actually harder to train that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to train 3 or 4 sets to failure than to train 20 sets not going to failure.
Yeah.
Most of the guys just couldn't take it.
Yeah.
So they went back to the regular training. You know, Dorian is one of the few guys that actually stick to it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's kind of an ironic thing about that.
So when you saw Mentzer train, you saw him train all out like that, where they would do the force reps, the negatives, and all that stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. I saw him train once. I remember many times when it would be Mentzer, Casey Vader, mm-hmm. and Ray Mentzer, all three of them training. And sure enough, they'd all give each other force reps, very hard training. I mean, and they did not do a lot of sets.
Hmm.
I don't remember them doing any more than two or three sets per exercise. That's it.
Yeah. Hmm.
That's it. But it was the failure.
Yeah.
I mean, they'd go to failure and then go past failure. They'd do force rep.
Right.
Which Dorian also adopted that part of it.
Yeah.
He also had his training partners give him force reps, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, by the time you finished, if you trade 2 sets like that, I mean, all out force reps, I mean, where the weight is almost falling out of your hand, I would challenge anybody to try and do 20 sets like
right.
that.
It's impossible, yeah.
Because I did it myself in the early 70s.
Uh-huh.
I made tremendous gains using that system, but I remember doing barbell curls where the weight would literally, I couldn't even hold it. I'd go to failure so hard that the weight, I couldn't hold it. I had to drop the weight out of my hands. And after 2 sets, I tried to do another bicep exercise. I couldn't even contract the muscle. It was dead.
Yeah.
Dead.
Yeah.
It was dead. Before that, I was averaging, 15 to 20 sets for biceps.
Yeah.
Doing 2 sets high intensity killed the muscle.
Right.
That's why these people, you know, a lot of these people try that today, but they don't really go to failure. They you know what? They stop right when the muscle starts to hurt.
Yeah.
That's the point to failure.
Yeah.
Going to failure means that you can't move the muscle. You can't even move the weight.
Right.
The muscle has failed, literally failed.
Right.
I don't see anybody training like that now. Nobody.
Right.
Nobody trains like that now.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's too hard. It's very painful.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Arnold saw me training like that in the early 70s. He came up to me. He says, "You're doing that Arthur Jones stuff, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "How's it working?" I said, "Arnold, I said, people think I'm on drugs, and I'm not, because I'm making so many gains." He said, "Okay, it's good for a while." He says, "But you know what?" He says, "You'll burn out on that." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Your mind can't take training that with that much intensity all the time."
Yeah.
He says, remember, I was, 20 years older than when this conversation took place. He says, even if your body can take it, your mind will give out. Mark my words, you'll see. I said, all right, okay. And in the meantime, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, Arnold's Arnold, but what the hell, I'm making gains.
Yeah.
Why would I stop doing it? I'm making constant gains.
Right.
I'm not even making drugs. I'm making more gains than the guys on drugs.
Right, right.
Sure enough, about 2 months later, I just couldn't take it anymore. I mean, even though I was only training 3 times a week, that's it.
Yeah.
Whole body worked out. But it got to the point where I just dreaded going to the gym.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so hard to constantly do that. I burned out. Luckily, I never got any injuries. Like Mike, he told me he got a lot of injuries. That's why he had to quit bodybuilding. It wasn't just that he losing the Olympia. He had like severe shoulder, elbow, all kinds. Same with Dorian.
Dorian too,
Dorian will tell you, he says in interviews, he retired. Not because he was afraid of people like Ronnie Coleman or anything. He retired because he had so many injuries, hamstrings, biceps, shoulders.
Tricep, yeah.
That he felt he couldn't train at 100%. That was his exact words. And he felt if he couldn't train 100%, he wasn't going to compete anymore. Same with Mike.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with Arnold. I think it is psychologically very hard to push your body that hard every workout. You know, I think it will get burned out.
It definitely is. And, you know, what I've written in my newsletter about it is that I still think it's a good way to train, but not all year.
Yeah.
So it's almost like we were saying about the steroids. You know, it's good for, I think it's good for, let's say, maybe 3-4 months at a time. Then you go back to, let's say, regular training.
Yeah.
But the really good thing about it is, let's say you've been overtraining for a while, let's say doing too many sets or too many exercises. If you go on a high-intensity weight training program where the sets are reduced tremendously, you know, but very high intensity to failure, it completely breaks you out of a training run.
You're
going to start making gains. You know, in fact, I came across a study not long ago. I'll be writing on it. It might interest you. They found that if, let's say, you're a guy like you or me, you know, advanced training, we've been training many years. Let's say, you know, well, let's say a younger guy than me, because I'm, you know, at my age, it's hard to make a lot of gains. But let's say a guy in his 40s, whatever. Let's say you've been in a plateau for a while. You haven't been able to make gains. What this study found is if you start doing eccentric emphasized exercise, which was also, by the way, recommended by both Mike Mentzer and Arthur Jones. And you know what I mean by eccentric negative.
Yeah. Lowering the negatives.
Well, you kind of even will do a heavier set that you can use to lower the weight, right?
Yeah.
Slow. This study showed it consistently broke the training run of advanced. In other words, they were able to actually add muscle size and strength, even if they hadn't done so in years.
Wow.
And that real eye-opening study for me. I said, wow, guys should know about this.
Yeah.
Because a lot of guys, I see it today in the gym, that they don't change.
Yeah.
Well, today it's a different. I attribute the lack of progress today. This will make you laugh, but I think a lot of it's walking around with the cell phone and all that stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I agree 100%, Jerry.
I got to tell you, at Gold's Gym, and I also train in another gym called 24 Hour Fitness, I got to tell you, 98% of the people, and I'm not exaggerating, 99%. Gym. I'm talking bodybuilders and just people in the gym.
Yeah.
Are walking around with the damn cell phones, and they're playing Facebook, I see them playing with their phones when they're doing an exercise. If Vince Garanda would have seen that, he would have ran up to him, taken the phone, and smacked the ground.
I know.
Because this whole thing was focus. You got to focus
on
muscle training.
Yeah.
You know, they don't understand there's a neuromuscular connection. When you're doing an exercise, you have to think about the muscle. You have to focus. Otherwise, the muscle is not maximally contracted.
Right.
If it's maximally contracted, you're not going to make the gains.
Right.
These people are walking around. I mean, you know, hey, you know, it's their business. I'm not going to lecture them. But the thing is, this is why they never change.
I know.
They year after year. No, and let me tell you, John, in the old days at Gold's Gym, let's say the original Gold's Gym, everybody made progress.
Yeah.
Not just the bodybuilding competitors. Everybody in that gym, somebody would join the gym, fat, skinny, whatever. You'd see them in 4 months. They had a complete metamorphosis.
Yeah.
A lot of people weren't interested in bodybuilding. They just came to get in shape, but there was no cell phones. There was no – they didn't even have a damn radio. They had a radio in the gym, which wasn't even turned on most of them. There was no music.
Right.
You know, there was no distractions. There was just concentrated, focused, serious training.
Yeah.
And I kind of yearn for the I even saw Arnold now about a year or two ago. He made a video where he actually talked about this. He says, if you take a cell phone in the gym, you're not serious. He said it right there in the video.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, it's funny because I use that as a yardstick for whether a person is serious. If they bring a cell phone to the gym, they're not serious. I don't have to know anything about them.
Right.
They're not serious. Because you know something? I have never, ever brought a cell phone onto the gym floor. I keep it in my gym locker. There are exceptions. If you're expecting a very important call, let's say you're married, your wife's about to give birth, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, cell phone in the gym. If you're some doctor on call, something like that, whatever, maybe a business, a very important business call.
Yeah.
You know, or let's say you're using the phone to record your workouts. They have apps where you can record.
Yeah.
You know,
workouts,
that's okay. If you're listening to music, that's okay. But if you're bringing the cell phone in, and most of them are, to play with Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah.
You can't do that outside the gym. You got to do that in the gym.
I know.
You're not serious. You can't do that. You're not serious.
It drives me crazy too. I mean, they're sitting on the machines. They're sitting on the benches. They're texting. It drives me nuts.
Well, I saw a woman on a leg press machine. She was playing with the phone, you know. And I had to do legs next. I was working on the body part, and I'm watching. A half hour goes by. She hasn't done anything. She's just sitting on the machine with the phone. You know, she hasn't done in a half hour, hasn't done a single set.
Yeah.
So I walked up to her, and she had this big, tough boyfriend nearby. I didn't give a care crap. I walked up to her. I said, "Miss, excuse me, are you using this machine?" And so it's almost like I woke up. She was, you know, doing this on the. It's almost like she woke up and said, "What? I said, "Are you using this machine?" She said, "Oh, no, I'm sorry." And she got up and ran away.
She was just sitting there.
Right, just sit. And the boyfriend gives me a dirty look. Because I needed to use a machine.
Right.
Can you believe this?
Yeah.
This is the mentality I have to deal with now.
I know. I was doing legs a couple of weeks ago, and there was a guy on – we got one good leg press machine at the gym. And he's on it, and he must have had 900 or 1,000 pounds on it. And he's doing – it wasn't even a quarter rep. It was maybe an eighth of a rep. And he had his hands on his knees. It was way too heavy for him. And he did a couple of reps. He racked it. And right away, he goes on his phone. And then he's on his phone for at least 5 minutes, searching Facebook, texting, whatever. Then he put in more weight on the plate, you know, more weight on the machine. Do the same thing. Hands on the knees. His legs are shaking. And he'd do maybe like 6 reps. And it wasn't even quarter of weight on. It wasn't even close to half. And then he'd rack it and right back on the phone again. It's so ridiculous.
And not long ago, I saw a guy at Gold's Gym, you know, again on the leg press. This guy has like 14 plates on each side, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was when it was warmer. I looked down on him. I look at his legs. He has like a 12-inch thigh. I'm thinking, I said, what the hell is this guy going to do with this weight?
Yeah.
If he gets under this weight, he's going to be crushed.
Right.
So, you know, I was doing a machine nearby. I said, I better hover around this guy because this guy's going to be literally broken in half if he tries to get under that machine.
Yeah.
So, sure enough, you know, he's playing with his cell phone again like these other. And, he gets ready to do his set. He gets under there. And I start to kind of inch towards him because I think this could be, you know, this could be a mortality here in the gym, you know. So I'm inching towards him. And he gets under and he puts his feet on the platform. And I'm not kidding you, Johnny. He moves the thing. He didn't even barely move it off the, you know, the things that hold he moved it. It maybe was a quarter of an inch. He did two of those and he got up and went back on his cell phone.
Gosh.
And I went up to him and I said, hey, I said, hey, buddy, I said, my legs are bigger than yours, and yet you use so much more weight than me. I said, how do you manage that? He says, I don't know. I saw it in a video. I had to laugh.
Intelligent answer.
This is the kind of things you run into today.
I know. I was working out last night, and I was looking around. And I go, okay, phone. There was at least 10 people in front of me on their phones.
Yeah, that's what it is at Gold's Gym and all the other gym. Everybody on the phone. I mean, you know, what would happen if they suddenly didn't have cell phones?
I know.
Would that, what, these people would quit training?
Yeah, probably. I remember a story Frank Zane said, and you might have even told me this. This might have been your story. He said he was training. He would focus, you know, right? When Frank would train, he would focus so much on his workout. And he said he went to the water fountain to get a drink, and he came back, and somebody started talking to him, asking him a question. And he talked to the guy a few minutes. He said when he went back to his workout, he lost his focus, and the workout was ruined.
Yeah. Well, I had an experience with Frank myself right around the time we were talking about, in the early 70s, right around the time he was, when he was winning the Olympia. I knew Frank very well. Of course, we lived next door to each other. I had his trophies there for a while.
Yeah.
So I went up to him, and I went to ask him a simple question. I think it was something about low-carbohydrate diet or something like that. I said, I went up to him, if he was training, I said, hey, Frank, I said, I want to ask you about the low-carb. So he puts his hand up like this, and he goes, send me an email. not send me. They didn't have email then.
Yeah.
He said, what did he say? Oh, no, and he said, make an appointment with me. That's what he said. Make an appointment with me. And I was on a ketogenic low-carb diet at the time. And I don't know if you remember, sometimes they would make those diets would make you a little irritable.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I had been on the diet for like 6 weeks. That's why I wanted to ask Frank a question about it. And I was very irritable. And when he went, like, he says, make an appointment. I literally went crazy. I started saying, What are you fucking talking about? Make an appointment. I started calling him a bunch of names and stuff and cursing at him. And I remember Frank, he just stared at me. He stood there and stared at me.
Right.
And he didn't say a word. And I just calmed down and walked away. And he didn't talk to me for 5 years after that.
Wow, 5 years.
I didn't even acknowledge my presence, right?
Yeah.
But we kind of made up one time. I went to a contest just as a spectator, and he had a booth set up. He was selling his I think he had courses or whatever he was selling, and I walked by thinking, oh, he's not going to say hello to me, and all of a sudden I hear him say, hey Jerry, how you doing? I said, hey Frank, and I went, the first thing I said, I went up to him and I shook his hand. I said, listen Frank, I really apologize about reeling into you like that. I said, but I was on a real keto gym. That's what I wanted to ask you. I said, and I just lost my temper. I'm really sorry. He says, that's okay. He says, water under the bridge. It's all right. And we've been friends ever since.
Yeah.
In fact, Frank gave me this really great compliment at Joe Weider's memorial. You know, after Joe Weider died,
I saw
Frank there. He was like leaning against the wall. Not, I was sitting with Corey Everson and her sister Cameo, and I walked over to Frank to say hello. And I said, hey, Frank, how you doing? How's everything? And he says, it's great. How you doing? I said, all right. He says, Jerry, I want to tell you that your articles are the only articles I ever read in the magazines. And he goes, I mean the only articles. And I said, wow. I said to myself, Frank Zane saying this? I really felt, I said, thanks a lot, Frank. I really appreciate that. I never forget that. I mean, the thing is, because Frank's not an idiot. I mean, for him to say that he reads my articles was a great compliment. Apparently, I guess he had his own newsletter for a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And somebody told me, I never saw it, but somebody told me that he actually wrote that in his newsletter.
Oh, really?
That
wow. Article, nice.
With the articles that he read in the magazines. That was pretty nice of him to do that.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Old School Labs in Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We will be back next week with part 3 of our interview with Jerry Branum, where we're going to talk about the year 1988. So until then, have a great week, everybody. Take care, and we'll see you next week.